So just pass around the attendance sheet. Look a little bit at chapter 7, and we'll also just tidying up a few parts from the previous unit that we perhaps need to cover a little bit more, a bit more detail, and a little bit of discussion about these days. We did the exam, of course, last week. We won't discuss. So we have been looking at Lord Brahma's prayers and Lord Brahma's answers in response to the question from Narada Muni. We're doing that to get a little glimpse into some of the things that happened at the very beginning of creation, and Lord Brahma is giving us the understanding that there is a supreme personality of Godhead who is Brahma's worshipable Lord, and who in fact is the source of Brahma's power and inspiration for his own work in the creation of the material world. We discussed a little bit about the chapter 6 of the Purusha Sukta confirmed, describing when Brahma wanted to create, he prayed to the Supreme Lord. And he worshipped the Supreme Lord. And in order to worship that Supreme Lord, he literally had to, official worship, he literally had to utilize ingredients from the very body of the Lord. As a result of the worship, of course, we see that the universal form, the Virata Rupa, act further with regards to secondary creation. So some of those, what happened after the Sukta prayers, we will look at in further chapters and further units in more detail, and also in more detail we'll see how the nature of inspiration that the Brahma got, his communication, what sort of communication he actually got from the Supreme Lord, and how that manifests. A lot of those things we'll discuss later. We have described that the fight by Srila Prabhupada. We know that the first two cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam represent the Lord's lotus feet, and progressively, as one becomes purified in consciousness, one gets the qualification to understand more confidential understanding about the nature of the Lord, his name, his form, his pastimes. Purification ultimately, in a nutshell, means becoming free from attraction to enjoying the material energy. And the most powerful form of attraction to the material energy is of course represented in sex life. So you know, progressively with Srimad Bhagavatam, as described in the second canto, one should become more and more purified in heart, and that manifests that, you know, one's desire for or attraction to sex life should become, you know, weaker and weaker and weaker, practically till it is completely not present. That you know, a person has is just suddenly nectar. That there is no room for even a trace of Maya. So we see that, you know, therefore, in this canto, Srila Prabhupada does gives a couple of strong purports in relation to, you know, becoming free from sex desire. It's probably one that we should look at in the seventh chapter of the second canto, in verse number 6. It describes the incarnation of Naranarayana Rishi, born in the womb of Murti, the wife of Dharma, and the daughter of Daksha. Now, Naranarayana Rishi is one of the significant factors of his pastimes was that his companions, celestial beauties of Cupid, went to try to break his vows. But they were unsuccessful, for they saw that many beauties like them were emanating from him, the personality of God. So there are some very strong statements in there relating to statements relating to women and statements relating to the male form. Even by devotees, not to speak of others who may read this from above, so therefore they need a little bit more clarification. Now we see here that basically this purport Srila Prabhupada is stating that human life is meant for tapasya, austerity, with a great vow of celibacy or brahmacharya. Now, his next sentence is, in the rigid life of tapasya, there is no place for the association of women. So that's one of the statements, of course. We only got one woman here, you need to get backup. Okay? You're going to need some backup, I think. Get on the phone. So, alright, who would like to try and put that into some sort of context where it would not be a statement that would cause some, you know, vexation to women, and at the same time carries the import of, you know, what Prabhupada is stating here. What's that? What's that? Yes, yeah, good point. That it is specifically relating to illicit sex. Yeah. So that's a very good point. we see in the purport that Prabhupada says that, you know, therefore one is trained as a brahmachari, or he says one is trained under the guidance of a spiritual master, just to understand that woman is the real binding force in material existence. If one wants to get freedom from the material bondage of conditioned life, he must get free from the attraction for the form of woman. Woman or the fair sex is the enchanting principle for the living entities, and the male form especially in the human being is meant for self-realization. The world is moving under the spell of womanly attraction. As soon as a man becomes united with a woman, he at once becomes a victim of material bondage under a tight knot. So, again, a lot of statements there, very strong statements. The desire for lording over the material world under the intoxication of a false sense of lordship specifically begin just after a man's unification with a woman. Studying the whole scheme of disassociation from woman, it appears that a woman is a stumbling block for self-realization, and that Lord Narayan appeared, and the Lord appears as Narayan to teach the principle of womanly dissociation with the vow in life. So, one has to understand, both men and women, of course, that spiritual advancement means gradually understanding the illusory nature of material existence, and understanding the reality of spiritual existence, and being attracted more to the spiritual world rather than the material world. Now, Prabhupada sums up the way Krishna manifested this material in the human form of life, even not just so much the human form of life, but generally, that. Especially the human form of life, actually. But the human form of life, when one takes birth in the male body, according to the way the material universe is designed by Krishna, that spirit soul is meant for developing self-realization. And by that, in other words, in general, and if we're taking all the various processes of yoga, it is more easily, readily easy for a male person to become completely, to reduce the necessities of life down to a minimum. There's a very practical application here. For instance, when you have children, it is possible that after having children, that men may, reduce their material facility again more quickly than the women, because the women actually literally by their, physical body are meant to stay with the child and literally breastfeed the child over the course of many, many years. Of course, now, breastfeeding is done for a few months. But previously, breastfeeding would go for many years. The children may be 5, 6, 7, 8, to some degree still breastfeeding. Within that time, just by the very physical body of a woman and the physical body of the child dependent on the nourishment of a woman, there's a practicality that of the two, the male and the female, who are perhaps one who's going to be more on hands providing the material facility for the child, the woman actually would in practicality have that role. So in other words, if the man were not present, say if the man passed away, he died, got ill, gone, it's, you know, all the nourishment can be provided by the mother. If the mother passes away and the father's there, the father's, you know, can be in some sort of difficulty. They can make arrangements, but the child certainly wouldn't get the same nourishment from breastfeeding and what have you. And, you know, a lot of those different practicalities. So, you know, there's a lot of different things just on a very realistic, practical level, just because of the way the material body is, that the way the material body is designed, that it's not necessary. The male form, there's less encumbrances on some levels, whereby you know, they have the opportunity to you know, reduce material facilities and actually become fully dedicated to self-realization. That opportunity is there for women, but more difficult. Did I get any comments just on that sort of line of thinking? Any thoughts, good or bad, opposing arguments? Yes.
So it's just absolutely
that love. Yeah, so on the question of bhakti, yeah, there's no difference.
Yeah.
And Krishna states that in the Bhagavad Gita, that because bhakti is actually dealing with the spirit soul, and the process is a spiritual process, and bhakti is not dependent upon any material qualification according to birth or body, that opportunity is equal. Now, could you apply that to the other processes of yoga the same? Cultivation of knowledge goes hand in hand with austerity. So, if someone is, for instance, if someone is cultivating knowledge and not the body, decided to reduce their eating to the bare minimum, do you think it would be more difficult for a man compared to a woman who may be breastfeeding a child? There's definitely some. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of different, you know, if you carefully look at all the different factors involved in what it takes to perform karma yoga, jnana yoga, and astanga yoga, on those, because they actually depend upon the psychophysical makeup, there is differences. But on the, but you're correct, on the platform of bhakti, there is no difference.
Yeah. That's from a material fact. Female has more necessities. You know, they want to be beautiful and they want to have more clothes. For example, I would go to a shop and Julie would like to buy many things, and I would say I don't care. It's just that it's a bit different. Like in female nature, it's, you know, like they want to have things to you know, look beautiful, and that's from my experience. Male care less than female about that. Although today it's being promoted like male should do the same thing in the media today. They have all the stuff for male.
But who do they want to look beautiful for?
I almost missed that point. The reason is, so what Prabhupada says, that when you get with a female, you have the need to satisfy her desire because you are husband. So basically, your attachment to material grows with you being married. That's my experience.
Are there any statements in our purport that may relate to, you know, what you've just said there?
I'm not sure. I'm just talking from my experience.
Is the woman or the fair sex is an enchanting principle for the living entities and the male form, especially in the human being?
There is some support. There's some support in the sense that when we enter a particular body, we do tend to think in those terms of that body and act in those terms. So, philosophically, it's not incorrect to say that, you know, for women, they're definitely on average, they may put more work into it than men. Men may be, they have a natural laziness in that regard. But, as you say, in this age, men are actually acting more like women. Now, what do we find when men act more like women? They do take more notice in, you know, what they wear, their hairstyle. You know, it's actually well known that that is certainly more prevalent in this day and age.
When you come to the temple, you want to be like, you want to shower, you want to chill out, wear a
perfect
clothing. Yeah. So people would be talking about those practices for spiritual life. They're all appearance for male. Is equally as important for female. They have to like shave their head at the right time and shower and do all the same thing.
So it's a fact that on the platform of bhakti, a person's natural tendencies can be applied for spiritual progress. But it doesn't, a person doesn't have to act in an unnatural way according to their body and mind in order to make progress. If we say that just the way the material, the subtle and the material body of women and their social group and just the whole, you know, influence of the world in general upon women, you know, because there is a pressure that they should, even if they're not so concerned, that the general pushing of the world and society is, oh, you must look beautiful from beginning to end. Women can apply that, either they have a tendency or there's a social etiquette, and they can apply that in bhakti for self-realization. On the other hand, men in general may not necessarily have that tendency as much. They've certainly got it, and more in this age they have that tendency. But there may not necessarily be the social pressures of etiquette that they have to take as much care of. And they can also apply that in bhakti. But again, in other processes, applying one's natural tendency according to the body one has in self-realization is actually not allowed in other processes. In other processes, generally, one has to renounce one's natural tendencies according to the body, you know, one is in. So it doesn't apply there in other processes, but it does apply in bhakti. At the same time, you may get self-realized persons. So you may have women who are fully self-realization. They have no tendency, literally, to act according to the material body as a female, thinking that themselves are female. They're completely aloof from the concept that I am this material body. But those self-realized women may still act in such a way that to show those who are a little conditioned, who are trying to come to the devotional service, how to engage their natural propensities in the service of Krishna. And if they didn't show them that, then young neophyte devotees would artificially renounce and cause themselves a lot of trouble, being very unstable. So, you know, again, in bhakti, so, you know, one of the things, of course, we have to, you know, in looking at these statements, one, how it applies to bhakti, and two, how it applies to any other process of self-realization, which is completely different. We're looking at chapter 7, verse 6. Any other comments about that?
One more. Yeah? It's time for the dinner time.
Okay.
Talking about the relationship between female and male, and the complaint from the female side was that male was not able to control himself sexually as much as female. They can do it easier. They don't have so much attachment towards sex.
Mm.
While with male, it's much more difficult to control himself.
Mm.
So actually, the with husband and wife, many times Mataji, they were complaining like husband cannot control himself as much as we can do it in the relationship.
It's not so much that it goes both ways. We're not trying to, you know, one point for them, one point for us. But it does show a difference in the mentality between males and women in general. You know, that women may be more satisfied, you know, with, you know, they have a nice husband and children like that. They may not necessarily need the constant sense gratification from sex life. That may be there in men. That's a fact. That can be there. So it does show a slight difference in the way that male and female, what type of satisfaction they're searching for in the form of sense gratification, being attracted to the material energy to provide that sense gratification. You know.
Just as a general statement,
yeah.
You know, human life is meant for
yes.
There is no place for the association of women.
Mm.
It's quite an inflammatory statement if you present that in a preaching context to people.
Oh, who it
are
very.
Not.
Oh yeah,
but
yeah.
People would get very angry at that stage.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'm not going to say that. Like, I don't know how to get that. You know, how to present that message without sounding creepy, virtually.
Yeah. That's why we're having this discussion. One. So that, one, we don't want people reading the Srimad Bhagavatam and going out and quoting something like that to a person who will take great offence to Prabhupada, his books, the movement, to Krishna, not having the ability to understand that statement. At the same time, as teachers of the world in general, the devotees have to speak the truth. So we do have to, at some stage, every person who wants to go back to the spiritual world has to come to grips with the fact that they have to, if they want to progress properly on the path of self-realization, there is no place at all for attraction to the opposite sex. Now, in several lectures, an easy way to present that to people is that Prabhupada has done so in his here first he's presenting the natural order of the universe. Now, quite often we get to, in Kali Yuga everything is disturbed and backwards. But let's go back to the way things are naturally. If you go back thousands of years, when men are men and women are women, and the way their body and mind functions is very distinct without everything being topsy-turvy these days. In that situation, it's more obvious that men are meant for self-realization on any path of karma, jnana, astanga, what have you. And bhakti is very rare anyway. And women are the attracting force, enchanting force of the universe. That is, one of the way that the material energy is literally, when the material energy wants to attract a spirit soul, you stay in the material world, it presents the form of a woman. So that's the natural order. So of course now things are a little topsy-turvy, it's very hard to make the distinction, but we have to first go from that point. Now, whether we take Kali Yuga standard or go back in time the way things are naturally, we can present this argument that for man, the female form is woman, and they should not be attracted to the material energy in the form of the opposite sex. And for women, the man is the woman or the enjoyed, and one should not be, the women should also not be attracted to the material energy in the form of the male as something to be enjoyed. The whole point is that we should not be looking at the material energy that, I am attracted to that form to enjoy. So women, if women look at men, the form of men, as the opportunity for enjoyment in the material world, it is the same mentality as men looking at women. The only difference is that the form of a woman is naturally more enchanting than the form of a man. And the other difference is that when one takes birth in the form of a male, especially with other processes of yoga apart from bhakti, it is somewhat more easy to follow the path of self-realization. It's a little more difficult for women because of the fact that they will have children, what have you like that. So there are two points there. But if you present like that, so in this age, because people, we don't have the time to speak to someone for 20 minutes and explain, well, this is what it used to be like. Men used to be like this and women used to be like now. People don't, you know, anything in the past is useless. Unless it's modern, don't tell me about it. So we have to deal, somehow you have to, in one or two statements, you have to present that information in such a way that I can understand. And the easiest way to do that is say that, you know, on the path of self-realization, the material energy is always attracting us to enjoy in the material world in the form of the male or the female. We should not be attracted by that if we want to go back to the spiritual world. We have to be attracted by our spiritual nature. You can present that information like that. If you have more time, you can, you know, go over the entire, you know, way the universe works, and it's not an easy job. For us, because we've studied Bhagavad Gita and Upanishad and Srimad Bhagavatam, there are so many things that, you know, even in this short time, we already have a background. And even for us it's difficult. And the more someone has a background in, you know, Vedic knowledge, the more you can actually just present the information. And the less they have that, then we have to take the meaning of it and couch it in the way that they can understand without any background information. No, go on.
Enjoying the material energy basically means warding it off of material nature.
Mm.
But does that equate to attraction to women, or does that equate to like having powerful positions, like being a politician? And
all of them. Yeah.
That's separate from attraction to women. Like, you know, you can still enjoy or attempt to enjoy the material world by being wanting to be a powerful person.
Yeah.
And that doesn't involve necessarily attraction to women. You can just want to like rule the world, so to speak.
Yeah. It's
but it's still enjoying.
If we look at it very carefully, very scrutinizingly, it comes under the category of subtle sex life. Subtle sex life means that there are many things we can do to enhance our sex life. We can attract, the more powerful we are, the more beautiful women we can attract. Otherwise, they may not have anything to do with us. And, you know, when you see, like, when you get to the age of the Prime Minister of Italy, Berlusconi,
yeah.
When you get to that age, and, you know, a normal 17-year-old woman, you know, wouldn't even look at you, but if you have power and money, all of a sudden you find that you're very attractive. So, and the other thing is that even if a person is, you know, aged and really doesn't have sufficient power or influence to really attract, you know, the young, youthful woman for, you know, sex life as they would like to, there's still at least the subtle enjoyment that, you know, they may get just a little respect from a beautiful woman, or a little attention from a beautiful woman. If that's as close as they'll get to, you know, sex life, then that's because they're so addicted to sex life. Then, you know, the people will, you know, we see that people who are, you know, prime ministers, people who are in a position that if somehow or another they were discovered for their underhand activities trying to get some sex life, that it will cause them and their family, and, you know, they would go down in history, you know, as the most abominable persons, and destroy their family and destroy their presidency and destroy everything. They're so addicted to sex life that they will risk it. So strong is the sex desire. So it is that profit adoration distinction is basically how Prabhupada sums it up. It is subtle sex desires, profit, adoration, distinction. Profit, we gain some profit. It actually increases our ability to spend and provide facility that is attractive for sex life. Adoration, you know, that people would perform activities by people which will adore us, especially attractive women. And distinction, that, you know, there may be 200 men, but we want the women to notice me. You know, profit, adoration, distinction are this. It's all going, it's actually subtle sex desire. And therefore you see in some of Philip Prabhupada's Berkeleys and what have you that, you know, people are building huge bridges, you know, and massive skyscrapers and massive this and massive this. Underlying it is this subtle sex desire, which is without the sex desire, people would probably be just living like the scriptures say, sit down and chant Hare Krishna, but because they have sex desire, they go out and build mighty bridges and this and that in order to create a wonderful environment for sex, the opportunity. One time, just sort of sense of humor. One time, I think he was in India, and he went to like a program. And, the gentleman, so many people came and just quietly Prabhupada turned to one of his disciples and says, "Here is my sex life." It's because it's not that the Vedas are treating them as inferior, therefore not giving them Brahman initiation, but because there's no need. When she marries a Brahmana, she becomes a Brahmani, by qualification, by class, by status, by activities, by her mentality. It's automatic. So because something's automatic, there's no need to do something necessary. When she marries a Kshatriya or a Vaishya, automatically, that is there. So why make some artificial ritual when something's automatic? But because people misrepresent the scriptures or the things that they see in the scriptures, Prabhupada, following the mood of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, also the devotees, the men who were not born in Brahmana families, who were initiated, even initiated by a Brahmana, sannyasi, they're also not supposed to get the Brahmana thread. They can sit in the next lifetime, they're still considered to be, consider them to be sudras or what have you. But Srila Bhakti Siddhanta introduced that no, although they're not born in Brahmana families, the men, I'm awarding them the thread. He introduced that they will get the thread. Before that, even in our Vaishnav line, men were not necessarily, they were getting initiated, but not necessarily getting the Brahman thread. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati introduced that because the conception is that people were thinking, well, they're, you know, they've taken initiation, but they're not very elevated. He wanted people to know, no, you must understand that when someone is trained by a Vaishnav, they do become real Brahmanas in this lifetime, according to Shastra. And in fact, they are greater than someone who only remains a Brahman and never becomes a Vaishnav. So Bhaktisiddhanta, so, you know, it's not just women who weren't getting the thread, men were also not getting the thread. But, so, you know, the reason Bhaktisiddhanta introduced that men get the thread and are accepted as full-fledged Brahmanas, but because there's no history of, you know, women need to even undergo that ceremony because it's an automatic process where through marriage they become Brahmin and what have you, there's no need to, you know, do something completely outside the Vedas there. Even among devotees, even devotee couples, husband and wife, the tendency in this age that even among the devotees, the women don't necessarily become as attached and tuned in with their husband as what women previously were. Well, he awarded Brahmani because he wanted people in the West and the East to know that these women are full-fledged, you know, Brahmanis. And therefore, you know, he wanted the women in our movement to understand that yes, you are also a Brahmani. So, you know, here, look, there's a ceremony. But there's no need for the Brahman thread, because that doesn't exist in the scriptures. It's more automatic. Any other questions or comments? Anyone? So do you feel after that discussion that you will find it, you know, if someone you know was reading the Srimad Bhagavatam very new and they come and say, oh, I've read this, I'm shocked, do you feel more confident that you could discuss that?
They call in media a sound bite. It's like it hits you in the face.
Yes.
Take it in parts.
Break it down.
Break it down. Yeah. Yeah. Then you can explain it. But if you just say it in your face, people react quite badly.
Sometimes. So then, as you say.
But if you say it and then.
Yeah, sometimes that's it. So therefore, within that split second where the opportunity is there to respond, you've got to assess the background. Oh, this person has no background knowledge, which means I have to take that phrase and just say it in a way that they can immediately relate to it. And I don't have time to give them the background, so I just have to speak it in another way. Oh, I see what you're saying. And then one sentence, oh, that's okay, I'm happy with that. You know, and then others, you know, may really want to challenge and discuss it, in which case then you may have the opportunity to break it down and give them the background and, you know, present other aspects of Vedic knowledge and like that. Many devotees who you know, who are considered to be somewhat senior in relationship to the rest of the devotees. So in other words, you know, maybe everyone else has been around for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, and they might have been around for 5. They're considered, you know, sort of senior devotee in that temple or preaching center. And but, you know, who may have, you know, because you do get, you will get men who come to the movement who are chauvinistic before they come. And as a lack of training and, you know, a lack of, understanding the philosophy, they seize upon such passages and, you know, gradually make their way through various preaching, you know, engagements and what have you, creating all sorts of problems. I've seen that happen a lot of times. One time I was, when I was in New Zealand, I was doing university programs, probably to about 3 or 4 different universities every week, just going and providing a $2 meal. So I used to cook it, take it, serve it, and then just talk to people. I did a very similar thing here when I was on the farm. I was doing 5 different universities. And I used to do it in Melbourne before I went to New Zealand. I used to do it in Adelaide. And, you know, university students, of course, are, you know, they're very intelligent. You know, something's out of place and they'll challenge it, you know, strongly, straight away. They're that age, they're that, you know, they're alert, they're in that frame, you know. And you have to be very, very careful what you say. So, no, I was going to leave that service because I think I was going to then manage Gopal's restaurant. So it had to be handed over to someone else, and they actually chose a devotee who was, you know, been around for the same length as I had, but he was a male chauvinist. Yeah. And, you know, he used to get these verses like that, and he'd sort of, he's always saying things about the women in the temple like that. And it took me, you know, because it was going to be a month or two before I sort of wound it up. And they chose him that he was here. And I fought tooth and nail that he wouldn't do it. And eventually they agreed. You know. So. Just, you know, years and years of work and just one statement, you get 50 people. You know, we'll run those hurries out of town and never come back. You'd be surprised how easy it is for, you know, to create havoc. I mean, I've seen devotees giving classes in Srimad Bhagavatam with a, you know, packed room, and all the women just walk out, you know, all the women just just get up and just walk in. And then just be disturbed for days and days as a result of, you know, a devotee misquoting something like that. So, I think it may have happened here once, many years ago. So, you know, these discussions are quite important. It's up to, you know, we're studying these things. There's the other Bhakti Vaibhava as well, very, very carefully, very scrutinizingly, and there's a responsibility on us to, you know, make sure that the proper, you know, mood and understanding pervades the devotees and the various preaching engagements. It's, you know, it's quite a big responsibility. We're going to look a little bit now at some other things in the seventh chapter, probably related to very much on this topic, in the sense that it's the essay, open book essay question for text number 4, one of the only ones I don't think we covered, that discuss the importance of preserving and distributing the message of Srimad Bhagavatam with reference to chapter 7, verses 51 to 53. And how is this definition relevant to you? Now, text 38 is somewhat significant, some of the statements in there. So just have a look at some of those statements in there as well. In that, Srila Prabhupada, of course, Lord Brahma gradually comes to the point where he's asking Narada Muni that we want you to distribute this message. You know, Lord Brahma has told him about the teachings of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is describing the glories of the Supreme Lord, who he is dependent upon, and he wants Narada Muni to distribute that Srimad Bhagavatam. In the purport, Prabhupada says that the higher caste of society, namely the intelligent class of men, guiding the destinies of the social orders, the administrative class of men guiding the law and order of society, and the productive class of men guiding the economic development of society, must all be properly well versed in knowledge of the Supreme Lord, knowing factually his name, qualities, pastimes, entourage, paraphernalia and personalities. The saints and the higher castes or orders of society are judged by their proportion of knowledge in the science of God or Tattvagyan, and not by any kind of birthright or bodily designation. Now, of course, you know, again, another thing we notice is that when Srila Prabhupada is speaking Srimad Bhagavatam, He is speaking Srimad Bhagavatam in the sense, you know, women may read, when they read the Srimad Bhagavatam, in one sense that it is being spoken to men, or, you know, it's just like here, Prabhupada says that, you know, the higher class of society, namely the intelligent class of men guiding the destinies, so, you know, Prabhupada doesn't often say men and women. He quite often speaks in terms of men. Again, we have to understand the background that when any man does something, he does so with his, you know, in conjunction, you know, with his wife. So, just as, you know, a king rules a kingdom with his queen, or, you know, a brahmana. The brahmana is supposed to perform all these yajnas, you know, along with his wife. You know, that is there. You know, it's sort of a statement of. It's like there's no need to state some things because some things are part and parcel of this statement. Hare Krishna. So, for instance, if I were to say, if there was, a woman sitting over here with a child, and I said, could you please come and sit over here, you would automatically assume that the young child is coming with her. I don't necessarily have to say, you know, it's automatically understood. Maybe she might have four children with her. So you say, oh, I'll ask the lady here to come and sit over here. So I might say, you know, Padmavati, you come and sit over here. I don't have to address each and every one of the children. It's automatic. So that's sort of the context in which Srimad Bhagavatam is spoken. It's not excluding, but in a Vedic sense, some things were automatically understood and therefore didn't need to be stated all the time. So, you know, we sometimes need to just mentally add those other things. So therefore, you know, it's saying that, you know, that the administrative class of men and women guiding the law and order, you see what I mean? It's like what is understood. So, now, he's saying that presently, because of the lack of training and culture in the upper section of social orders, they are no more to be designated as Dvijajanas, or twice-born, and gradually he says that no one can expect peace and prosperity from an uncultured class of men. Human society full of uncultured classes of men. We're just looking at 38 because there's some preliminary statements which are important to this. So Prabhupada says there that it's the duty of the leaders of men to take note of it and try to reform the social order by introducing the principles of twice-born men trained in the science of God consciousness. This can be done by expanding the culture of Srimad Bhagavatam all over the world. So you see that statement is very important to our other statements in verse 46. He set the scene there. Now verse 46... Now the translation is, surrendered souls, even from groups leading sinful lives, here he's got, again, such as women, the labourer class, the mountaineers and the Siberians, or even the birds and beasts, can also know about the science of Godhead and become liberated from the clutches of the illusory energy by surrendering under the pure devotees of the Lord and by following in their footsteps in devotional service. Now, okay. Here, Prabhupada is. Here's another statement which needs a little bit of background. Surrender souls, even from groups leading sinful lives, such as women, the labour class, the mountaineers, the Siberians, or even birds and beasts. Now, how can a bird and beast be sinful? Can birds and beasts be sinful? They can? What are they doing? Smoking dust? What are they? That's right. It's because of their sinful activities. Prabhupada is saying that from groups of people leading sinful lives, and therefore they have taken birth, not in the highest form of life as a demigod or someone who's... you know, in the best possible position for self-realization, but they've taken birth in bodies which are progressively more difficult for the path of self-realization. That's a result of sinful activity. So it's not saying that women lead sinful lives. But the more purified one is, the more one is able to take birth in a form that is the most conducive position for self-realization. Going back in the past, there was an obvious distinction. That distinction between as a result of sinful activities, but Krishna is awarding just an opportunity, you know, according to one's devotion. You know. So, you know, there are a lot of different facets there need to be understood. Okay, but basically people who have taken an unfortunate birth or a birth which is more difficult for self-realization, let's put it that way, than other forms, as a result of impiety, even those people can become liberated from the clutches of the illusory energy by surrendering unto the pure devotees of the Lord and following in their footsteps and devotions. In the purport, Prabhupada now, keep in mind, this is a moving mission essay. We want to be able to recognize statements which present mood, which may be slightly, you know, which is distinct from other Vaishnavas or other gurus, or, and his mission, you know, something that needs to be done, something he wants done. Yeah. Statement. The personality of Godhead may not be present before one's eyes, but if one is sincere in wanting such guidance, the Lord will send a bona fide person who can guide one properly back home to Godhead. There is no need of material qualifications for making progress in the path of spiritual realization. In the devotional service of the Lord, the only qualification is surrender. So that's an important statement. Doesn't matter male birth, female birth. Even you take birth as a bird or a beast, you're still not disqualified. Devotional service, no, you know. Surrendering oneself is in one's own hand. If one likes, he can surrender immediately without delay, and that begins his spiritual life. The loving representative of the Lord is more kind and more easy to approach. A sinful soul cannot approach the Lord directly, but a sinful man can very easily approach a pure devotee of the Lord. So here we see, one, a need for devotees to go out to people to preach. Because, in essence, the verse is pointing out that according to where someone has taken birth, according to their past impiety, they may find it very difficult to approach the Lord. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
How are you? Nice to see you. So, especially Krishna. What to speak of approaching the Lord, it is particularly difficult to approach Krishna because he is the topmost deity. Very, very difficult, you know, very, very elevated understanding. One needs to be very, very elevated in purity and spiritual realization and spiritual practices to approach Krishna above all other forms of the Supreme Lord. Just as, you know, if you go through the government, each progressive minister, you know, I want to see your manager. You know, it's very difficult to see his manager. And you may be lucky, oh, the manager may come out. Usually they won't. But then if you want to see his manager, very difficult. So Krishna is at the top, very, very hard. For impious persons to approach God on any level is very, very difficult, especially Krishna. So there's a need here for people, for devotees. Devotees, you can easily approach a devotee. Not only that, but devotees actually, not only make themselves readily available, but they literally search out people to help. So there's some preliminary understandings there. Now, gradually, we get to the verses that we want to look at. That text 51, 52, and 53. That, Srimad Bhagavatam, Brahma is saying to Narada, this science of God, Srimad Bhagavatam, was spoken to me in summary by the personality of Godhead, and it was spoken as the accumulation of his diverse potencies. Please expand this science yourself. In the purport, Prabhupada says, Srimad Bhagavatam is the science of God and it is a potent representative of the personality of Godhead. It's non-different from the Lord. It's the direct incarnation of the Lord in the form of sound. So therefore, people can't really approach the Lord very easily because of taking birth in an unfortunate situation due to their previous impiety. But a devotee can actually bring the Lord to them in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is non-different from the Lord. They'll actually be able to associate and understand the Lord, realize the Lord, eventually see the Lord, and be with the Lord through that Srimad Bhagavatam. And the devotee can literally bring the Lord directly to them in a way that, is very conducive for their. It's like a medicine in the sense that Srimad Bhagavatam is the Lord, but you can give someone a little bit of the medicine, and then you can give them a little bit more of the medicine, a little bit more. It's like if you have an atheist and you say, come with me, I'll take you to the temple, here are the deities, there is God. Like this, they say, what? I see, you've decorated those marble statues really well, and what's that? That funny smell, and all these strange people and the shaven hair and all this, So it's just, what was that term you used before? A sound. Soundbite, it's just too much. Bang! Oh, there's God. Ah. Srimad Bhagavatam, you can just give him a little tiny bit of God. One sloka. Like that. You can just increase as they have the ability, the purification. So it's very, and the devotee can literally bring it to them. So it's easily available, and then present the Supreme Lord, his association, in the tiniest little bit of medicine that they can handle. So, and therefore you see, the Prabhupada says, the ripened fruit of the Vedic tree drops from one hand to another without being broken by falling suddenly from a high branch down to the earth. Unless one hears the science of Godhead from the bona fide representative of the disciplic succession, for one to understand the theme of the science of Godhead will be a difficult job. Now, we've seen today that we've taken just one sentence out of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and it's taken us, you know, about women and what have you. We've really had to rack our brains to, you know, understand it properly. Now, you can't, therefore, there is a need for the Srimad Bhagavatam and the devotee to present it. It can't be just dropped in their lap. Well, you can drop it in the lap, but you then have to, you know, come and see them regularly and explain what you've dropped in their lap. But, you know, as they're reading it, come in. Verse 52, please describe the science of Godhead with determination and in a manner by which it will be quite possible for the human being to develop transcendental devotional service under the personality of Godhead, the super soul of every living being and the summum bonum source of all energies. There Brahma is saying himself also, you know, describe it with determination, so it's not easy preaching, especially the impious persons, but, and you do it in a manner which it's possible for them to gradually develop some devotion. So we're seeing here the importance of preserving, of course, is that in those few verses that we described, 38 and 46, they do elaborate on some of the points which come up in 51 to 53. But the importance is, of course, that you can't have peace and happiness or spiritual progress in society when it's run by uncultured people. And therefore, the importance of preserving the message of Srimad Bhagavatam is, you know, it creates a society which can be happy and peaceful and spiritually progressive. The importance of distributing the message, of course, is that the devotee, you know, must literally, the people are not prepared to approach God, not able to, so the devotee must distribute God to them in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam, and also distribute God to them in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam very carefully. In verse 52, the purport, Prabhupada says, prior to the age of Kali, there was no need for such a book of knowledge to know the Lord and his potential energies. And gradually in Kali Yuga, because of the sinful, you know, increase of sinful principles, people have become forgetful of their eternal relationship with God. Basically, spiritually, men are blind. You know, for a human society, in the darkness of ignorance, Srimad Bhagavatam is the torchlight to see things in proper perspective, seeing everything according to one's relationship with the Supreme Lord. Yeah? It is eternal, yeah. One, The book form, we can take it that way first. Certainly, a book of knowledge is something literally written, a book that you can hold, a piece of literature, not necessarily required in previous ages because Vedic knowledge was spoken. In previous ages also, generally people had a sense of God consciousness, predominantly society, mostly, and the average person there. We look at, even at the beginning of Kali Yuga, even sinful personalities recognize God, but they may have been atheistic in that they were averse to surrendering to God. So like Kamsa, and Ravana, they hated the fact that they resented the fact that there was Vishnu or God. They thought that because their understanding may have not been particularly well developed, where they think they can compete with God. Even atheistic persons are sort of recognizing that, Vishnu is a person. But the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam is eternal. And that knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam has been within the universe since the very beginning of creation. We see that it was actually spoken, to Brahma, a nutshell form. Srimad Bhagavatam has been within the material creation since the very beginning. As Vedic knowledge expands in various different ages, people are acting in relationship to the Supreme Lord to some degree, and also fulfilling their particular material needs in a civilized way, in a God conscious way. So that's it. In Kali Yuga, the difference is, of course, is that without really taking full shelter of the Supreme Lord, the influence of this age is so contaminating and forceful that without fully taking shelter of the Lord, there's no real possibility of peace and happiness or spiritual progress. In previous ages, you could recognize your relationship with the Supreme Lord and follow the Vedas in such a way that you can live happily, peacefully, and make some progress in spiritual realization. That's very difficult to do in this age. You either take shelter fully, or you're sort of, just dragged away by Maya. Yeah.
In previous
ages, did they have a problem with the Vedas? Some people did. Prahlad Maharaj did. Realization of Krishna is very rare in any age. A very, very, very rare understanding. But there are always some devotees who do understand the Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and preach that, and accept disciples and teach that. That's always there. But it's very, very rare. People may worship Lord Narayan according to try and become a devotee of Lord Narayan and go back to Vaikuntha generally is, you know, is more common. Extremely rare, you know, to be a Krishna Bhakta. So what's that? Yes, you know, that's a contribution that Lord Chaitanya gave, which is no one has ever given before. But you don't understand how difficult it is to be a devotee of Krishna, but even in Krishna, not so many, you know, who recognize that this Krishna is the person of God, not just another incarnation. You know, he's not an incarnation of Narayan. He's actually the source of the Narayan expansions. Not many people understood Krishna's actual exalted position as Krishna's presence. Even with Krishna's personal presence, many of the Yadus understanding of his position relationship to Narayan may not have been very well developed. In fact, I don't think it was. There's some. So even when Krishna was personally present, what to speak of when he's not present? It's very, very rare. And the last text, of course, let's see. We've still got this one. Srimad Bhagavatam is so scientifically presented that any sincere student of this great science will be able to understand the science of God simply by reading it with attention or simply by regularly hearing it from the bona fide speaker. Now, here Prabhupada makes the statement that reading it with attention, we do have to understand, of course, that Srimad Bhagavatam is scientifically presented by Sukadeva Goswami, and if someone reads it with attention, starting from the beginning and follows, you know, Sukadeva Goswami's train of thought to the very end, if they do that, that we understand the science of God. Or simply by regularly hearing it from the bona fide spiritual master, the bona fide speaker. So, of course, you know, many editions of the Srimad Bhagavatam do come with a commentary. You know, and. But there's also, you know, Sukadeva Goswami's own very expert scientific presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam. But especially reading Srila Prabhupada's Srimad Bhagavatam with commentary by, you know, Prabhupada's purports, even if one does not currently have a bona fide speaker to hear from, one will actually still develop the science of God. Now, what will happen, of course, if you read the Srimad Bhagavatam, if you read the Bhagavad Gita, you will very, very quickly read passages which state that you must approach a bona fide spiritual master. Within the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, the spiritual master's position is glorified from the very beginning. And anyone who's actually reading Srimad Bhagavatam properly and attentively from the very beginning will come to the point where within their mind they'll think, I want the spiritual master to understand some of the things from Srimad Bhagavatam that I'm finding very difficult. And as soon as one begins to do that, then Krishna will send the bona fide spiritual master. One will then begin the process of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, and they'll get the same result. But until the spiritual master comes, if for one reason or another one is for some reason or another, one has not the opportunity, someone's got a Srimad Bhagavatam and hasn't got the opportunity to hear it from someone else, Krishna will adjust. You know, Krishna is non, he will act as the super soul within the heart, and he will literally help that devotee to understand this, so that they can gradually understand the science of Godhead until such time as he will also then send the spiritual master to finish off that, you know. Narada was never advised to preach the principle of the Bhagavatam to earn a livelihood. He was ordered by his spiritual master to take the matter very seriously in a missionary spirit. So we've got to hear it from a bona fide speaker. And if we desire that, Krishna will send that. We saw that in the previous verse. But we should never hear it from someone who's, not doing it in a missionary spirit, but doing it in a, just to earn their livelihood. There's some. You know, most of these statements you would categorize as what? Mood or mission? A sort of mission, yeah, because they're describing things that sort of need to be done in the sense that Srimad Bhagavatam needs to be distributed, you know, preachers need to be properly qualified to speak Srimad Bhagavatam, the opportunity for people to hear Srimad Bhagavatam from, you know, people, you know, who are going out, you know, looking for the conditioned souls, the innocent people to teach Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, they're all part of the mission. Text 53, some of Prabhupada's mood comes out in here to some degree. Fanatics or fools may consider the Lord's activities and relationship with the external energy to be useless for them. And they may falsely claim to be higher participants in the internal energy of the Lord. Factually, the Lord's activities in relationship with the external energy and the internal energy are equally good. On the other hand, those who are not completely free from the clutches of the Lord's external energy should devoutly hear regularly about the activities of the Lord in relation with his external energy. They should not foolishly jump up to the activities of the internal energy. Falsely attracted by the Lord's internal potential activities like his Rasa Leela. So Prabhupada goes on to describe this at more length. You know, later he says, rather the descriptions of such activities of the Lord as the Purusha Avatars are specifically meant for persons who are in the clutch of the external energies. And topics like the Rasa Leela are meant for the liberated souls and not for the conditioned souls. The first 9 cantos prepare the ground for hearing the 10th canto. A pure devotee of the Lord therefore must begin reading or hearing Srimad Bhagavatam from the very beginning and not from the 10th canto. There is a mission also in the sense that we should stamp out that nonsense and be properly, you know, trained. But as Prabhupada's mood. Prabhupada's mood perfectly reflects that verse, you know, that the Lord's activities and the association of his different energies should be described, appreciated and heard in accordance with the teachings of the Supreme Lord. If this is done regularly with devotion and respect, so Prabhupada sums up what it means to have proper respect for the teachings of the Lord, not just jump haphazardly into confidential subject matters, nor to teach confidential subject matters. You know, it's great disrespect. You know, just as if you introduce someone to your wife or husband, you might, you know, someone you've just met, you might say, oh, you know, yes, this is my partner, you know, her name is so and so. That's about all you tell them. You know, you know, there's a lot, you know, you don't just start, there's no kiss and tell. There's no, you don't tell them all the intimate details of your, you know, your romance and, you know, like this. You know, gradually as people become, very, very confidentially associated with the person, that they may find out, how did you two meet, you know, where did you meet, you know, like these sort of things, you know, may come up. And a person may get to intimately know some confidential, and very disrespectful, you know, for a stranger. Imagine if you began to speak about someone who's supposed to be very, very dear to you, just telling a complete stranger intimate details about that person. That person, the wife or the husband, would think, you know, that was so disrespectful for you to say. Who's written that essay yet? No? Let's talk about essays. The essays are improving. Getting good. I've got a couple of them, not all of them, but some. I'm going to ask everyone to do a word count, to literally put your word count underneath, right? Because, so I can see it and to remind yourself of, you know, how much you're writing. How much you're writing and how much you're not writing. So if everyone can, you know, keep to the word count. Generally it's about, if we're doing four essays, it'll be about 250 words. 250 to 300 is fine. Try not to go under that, and try not to go over. If you're doing three essays, there's only three questions, that'd be about, you know, 330, 350 words, like that. You know, some essays are like triple that, or too brief. I did explain just a couple of points. One is, if it's too brief, now, for instance, a lot of the essays, you know, we are choosing topics which take a little bit of expertise to sort of preach, you know, to get that knowledge across to others. So we took one topic today about, you know, how to properly understand and speak about statements about women in our movement. Now, if you write too little on that subject, you really, you know, there's just going to be a lot of holes in your argument. You know, there's going to be a lot of people saying, oh, yeah right, well, you know. You know, you've got to take the full 350 words and, you know, make sure that you're covering, that you've made a solid statement, you know, not with, you know, jumping from one thing to the other. Because, you know, most of the essay questions are tackling something which takes some expertise. So you're going to need that 350 words minimum. Now, at the same time, you know, the word count is double or triple that, I usually see that, you know, that a person is writing a lot of things that they don't need to write. They're certainly somehow related, but, you know, if I was a bit savage with the marking, I'd probably just get a red pen and go, this paragraph, that paragraph, that like that. But, you know, because they're nice sentiments and, I don't want to offend anyone, you know. But it really shows that, you know, when you stick to that workout, it means that, one, the student found the proper references. And then, you know, just presented not necessarily all the references, but enough to make a good overview of the question. And, you know, in their own statements, they've joined those references nicely into a cohesive and logical step-by-step statement. To a beginning from the beginning of understanding and building on that understanding. So, you know, personally, from seeing the essays, I think that you will all do, you know, it will be very valuable to just literally write that numerical count, that word count, and try very hard to stick to it. Not too little, not too much, yeah? Yep. All of that.
Every word.
Yep.
Every day.
Yeah. There's not the ones in between. No, you can't. Yeah.
Yeah,
the okay. Come on, find a paragraph. Who's got a short bug on here? Come on, find me a paragraph, count the words, which is about 350 words. Yeah? Well, you could get away with either, as long as there weren't too many of them in there. So if you're low on your word count, you can put Srimad. And if you're going over your word count, just leave out Srimad. Yeah, well, it depends. Depends whether you're above or below your word count. You can either put the Shemat or leave it out. You can. You know, sometimes if, for instance, Srimad Bhagavatam is going to be mentioned half a dozen times in your essay, you might, at the very beginning, when you first mention Srimad Bhagavatam, you might put in brackets SB, and then each time after that, just put SB. So, have you got one? Got 200? What page are you on? From the living, the condition, that's 200 words. Yeah. Basically, well, so it looks like from there to the bottom of the page, basically, right? So, I'll read this paragraph, which is about 350 words. We're looking at page 223, Canto 2, Chapter 4, Text Number 20. And we're taking up in the fourth paragraph, beginning with the words, the conditioned souls. Is it Prishni? Prishna, that's your new name. Because yeah. I was marking, I was thinking Prishna, and I was trying to think. It had to be you. Congratulations. All right. Okay. So, Prishna is saying that from the conditioned souls down to the bottom of that paragraph, material possessions, is about 200 words.
Yes, that's
The whole paragraph? Yeah, so, alright, these two paragraphs make up about the length of an essay. Let's read it. The conditioned soul, can you count how many sentences are there? While you do that, I'll read it. The conditioned soul strive to become lords of the material world. Everyone is trying to lord over the material nature by applying his highest degree of intelligence. The misuse of intelligence by the conditioned soul is called madness. One's full intelligence should be applied to get free from the material clutches. But the conditioned soul, due to madness only, engages his full energy and intelligence in sense gratification. And to achieve this end of life, he willfully commits all sorts of misdeeds. The result is that instead of attaining an unconditioned life of full freedom, the mad conditioned soul is entangled again and again in different types of bondage and material bodies. Everything we see in the material manifestation is but the creation of the Lord. Therefore, he is the real proprietor of everything in the universes. The conditioned soul can enjoy a fragment of his material creation under the control of the Lord, but not self-sufficiently. That is the instruction of the Upanishad. One should be satisfied with things awarded by the Lord of the universe. It is out of madness only that one tries to encroach upon another's share of material possessions. Prabhupada has put one paragraph there explaining how the conditioned souls foolishly, madly, would try to enjoy independently from the Lord, and they're better off rather than encroaching upon others, you know, share, which has not been allotted to them by the Lord, they're better off to live with their due allotment. Then he goes on to say, the Lord of the universe, out of his causeless mercy upon the conditioned souls, descends by his own energy, Atmamaya, to re-establish the eternal relation of the conditioned souls with him. So now he's brought in a new point, that the Lord descends to rectify this madness. He instructs all to surrender unto him instead of falsely claiming to be enjoyers for a certain limit under his control. When he so descends, he proves how much greater is his ability to enjoy, and he exhibits his power of enjoyment, for instance, knowing 16,000 wives at once. The condition, so there's a nice example there to prove that he is God. The conditions and the enjoyer. The conditioned soul is very proud of becoming the husband of even one wife, but the Lord laughs at this. The intelligent man can know who is the real husband. Factually, the Lord is the husband of all the women in his creation. But a conditioned soul under the control of the Lord feels proud to be the husband of one or two wives. So, two paragraphs there, make such a powerful statement and sums up completely the living entity's position in the material world and the difference between the Lord and the living entity and how the Lord descends into this world to rectify this and, while doing that, prove that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A lot of things there, two paragraphs. So, what you want to do is... you see that there's plenty of room there to get a good argument in. Prabhupada Srimad Bhagavatam, with his purports, could in fact be 10 times as big as what it is. And if it was, it would take us 20 years to do the Bhakti Shastri. We may never get to the Bhakti Vaibhava. Keep in mind what is 350 words. There's a huge amount of opportunity there. The other thing is, they are paragraphs. That is an essay. Sometimes in Prabhupada's paragraphs, he does put bullet forms and you know, the bullet things and say numbers. Occasionally, it's required. When there's a need for a list, sometimes that's required. Not every essay should be in the form of a list, you know, list. But sometimes it's required. It's more of a flowing essay. There's plenty of opportunity to present the full understanding, going from one. Prabhupada, as you read that purport, he goes from one point, the next point naturally leads to another point. The whole paragraph, you see Prabhupada's whole paragraph, that first paragraph, is actually making, you know, sort of one general statement. And his second paragraph makes another general statement. You know, the first paragraph he makes is about, you know, the foolishness of one thinking that he is the Lord of the living entities, the Lord of the material world, and that it's actually better that he cooperates with the Supreme Lord, who is actually the enjoyer of the material world. You know, the basic point there. The second point is that to rectify this, the Lord comes into the world, sets things right, and at the same time proves that he is the Supreme Lord. So it's basically two statements in two paragraphs, and to present those two statements, he has then gradually brought you to the understanding of those two statements. So, for instance, do we have any text? I think I did bring mine. I'm not sure if I put them in here. I left mine in my other bag. Do you have one? Yep. Let's do an example. Who would like to pick out two main points from what we just did when we looked at the importance of
before we write, we jot out our main points.
Yeah, definitely. Most definitely. So, yes, it's better to do that rather than hope that somewhere in the course of writing for 2 hours that you may come to. Yeah, that's one way of doing it. It doesn't always work. Okay, we looked at discuss the importance of preserving and distributing the message of Srimad Bhagavatam with reference to those verses, and then how is this mission relevant to you? Considering that there are five marks for discussing the importance of that, there's two marks for appropriate references, and then there's three marks for the how it's relevant to you. So the importance is, what would you say? Five marks. References is two marks. How it's personally relevant is three. And the whole essay was a mood and mission, is that right? Yeah. All right, let's ask. You know, someone just find what they found is the most significant point in that discussion about the Srimad Bhagavatam and its distribution. Who would like to say what they found was, you know, perhaps? Yeah.
A simple person can't approach the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? That's a very good point. it is very important. Anyone else? Something? Yes, yeah, that's part there. It equals contact, you know, it equals the Lord Himself. Yeah. That is, it's a very important point, and it's an important part of that statement. That would be part of that. In other words, what does a bona fide speaker do? Their qualifications. You know, they present it with respect and devotion, like that. So that is part of that, definitely. Anything else? The main significant statement of all of that that we discussed. What reasons are given?
He instructs all to surrender unto him instead of falsely claiming to be the enjoyers for a certain limit under his control.
Is that, which verse is that? You're in chapter 7? Chapter 2. Flip a few pages. We're in chapter 7. this is an open question. Yes. That basically means peace, you know, the happiness, and you know, spiritual progress, really. That whole thing of society, you know, people in society, probably the three most points, most people would sum up there. paragraph there, there's a paragraph there, there's three paragraphs. In what order, you know, would we put those paragraphs? You've got this one first. Alright, okay. Hands up. Alright, we'll start from the top. Hands up, this one first. We'll do one. Hands up this one first. One. Hands up this one first. Most. Alright. I'd probably go that one. Prabhupada did do that one first, I think. That one there. you know, it's possible to put that one there also, I think. I think that is, you know, also... But from memory, that one went first in Prabhupada's order. That peace and happiness and spiritual progress, you know, depend upon, you know, cultured people in society, cultured by education and training, especially through, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam. And then, you know, probably this one here, that, you know, a sinful person can't approach the Lord. You know, people become cultured by their God consciousness. And people are not going to be God conscious by themselves because of their impiety. It's difficult for them to approach the Lord. So someone actually has to bring the Lord to them. So that brings us to our third point. That, you know, it needs to be heard or given by a bona fide speaker. So, you know, there's your essay, there's perhaps two or three paragraphs. You can put them in the natural order before you even begin writing. One, you've got your 5 points because you've seen the importance. Right. You've seen the importance of distributing and preserving Srimad Bhagavatam. So if that is there, you've got your 5 points. If you then you've got to make references. Now there's a lot of references there. You can't put them all in. Sometimes you can, depends, you know, what's there, but if over several verses, you probably can't put all of those references in. So you might just want to, you know, take some of the essential ones that summarise as much as possible, and say, why do we give references? To what we're saying, because we may be saying something which is you know, you sometimes feel you need to say it's in the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, it's in Prabhupada's purpose, like that. So it gives authority or credence. Why else would you give a reference? Yeah, that's verification, credence. Yes, that's all. Yes, that's all part of this. It's authority, support. Sometimes Prabhupada says things in such a way that you just couldn't state it any better way. Right? So sometimes you just take his statements. It's just the best way to state it, and it really sums up a lot. So, you know, just basically, you know, you're presenting Prabhupada's concise words. or analogies. Or examples. You know, sometimes some of these things help you to say a real lot in the proper way. What I do notice is sometimes the students, with some of the points, especially they, when there's a little bit of difficult philosophy involved, I can see sort of part of what they wanted to say, but in presenting their sentences, they sort of they can trip themselves up a little bit and say something else that sometimes they don't intend to be, wanted to be saying, and get a bit. Sometimes it's just, it is good to present but it does give support. I know you've actually read the book. So you've read it? Yeah. And you've read it so well that you've been able to pick out the necessary reference. Not just any other reference. I read it and I grabbed this part. But so you've read it properly and understood it properly. The understanding is there. And, the other thing to reference is that we are asking for mute and mission. And to, you know, make the references, I can understand that, yes, you're understanding the mood and mission. The references are statements of mood and mission. We do want to know, you know, what Prabhupada thinks is important thing to do about this, and we also want to know if his mood is stated. Sometimes the mission is stated, sometimes the mood, sometimes both. If they are stated, it's good to be able to say, yes, I can recognize Prabhupada's mood and mission. So it shows that the aim is. So, you get 2 marks for the references. You can't put them all in. If you get something to show that you've met the aim, it's a really key statement that really helps your essay. And some of Prabhupada's statements are so wonderful that you really want to have them in the essay to make your essay look really good. You know, so. And finally, how is it relevant to you? There are 3 points there. Of everything that we, you know, read in that. Who would like to say, you know, how they feel is personally relevant for them to preach Srimad Bhagavatam and in a proper way. To distribute, to preserve its true meaning. You know, who would like to say how it's relevant? I can think of a lot. For myself, the amount of effort that I put into studying, you know, to prepare a lesson, to come along, what have you. And I think, yes, you know, I despite sometimes I think, oh, it's really so difficult. That, and then you see that and you think it's relevant to me because I can see that what I'm doing is very, very important for the benefit of everyone, individuals, and also, you know, as a world. Today, before I came here, program where some young devotees put Gaur Nathai in the room, and we had a little ceremony in Bhutan and I did a little talk. And, you know, each time I do one of those programs, I get this sense of, I was thinking, well, you know, here is another whole group of people who are no longer, you know, just in the world. They've made this, you know, Gornatai, the sense of their life, you know, and those people will influence many others like this, and you can see that, you know, just step by step, that this important mission will happen. Very important. Otherwise, there's no possibility of peace, happiness, what to speak is spiritual progress in the family, individually, in the community, in the nation. These things will never happen until, you know, us, individual by individual, community by community, state by state, people actually recognize the law properly and not fanatically. You know, they actually apply very widely the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then the nice descriptions we see of how the citizens live, how it's wicked, how it's resisted. If we can successfully implement that to a modern degree, we would be so much happier. Even to the slightest degree, the world would be so much happier than what it is in a world of, you know, godlessness. Everyone, you know, competing for self gratification, understanding like that. So therefore, you know, for me, that's my it's as a teacher, student, very, very hard for the students also to come up. So in this way, we have to then take them, you know, hopefully I'll get my 3 marks for relevance. And then, what's your essay? You know, you've got to list what you've got to do in the essay. If you're not sure, I can always give you a breakdown of the marks. Usually we don't do that, but until you get a little good run on how to do the essays, I will. What you've got to do, the aim, is relevance or is preaching application. Then, you know, some references, the proper references, a few key statements that really sum up that whole thing. According to the question, you may not even be asked to sum up the whole section. Sometimes the questions only ask you to just do something in that section and write about it. In which case, you may need to just do some part of it. It depends on what the question's asking you. And then, in that case, you may only choose one part of it. Write a sentence, write some paragraphs around that, and some references just related to what you're saying there. Every essay doesn't necessarily have to have every reference. Every essay doesn't necessarily have to summarise everything unless it's asking for it. What you do is, in brackets, you might put two, Sankana, dot, seven chapter, dot, 51, so second canon, yeah? Okay. And then just put the put P. Okay. Or you can put P U R, or just even. Was that? So, like, for instance, if you find a reference, you can just put after it that, 251. You can either just put P for purport, or you can put something like that. No, that's not. No, you can get away with it. Yeah, get away with that one. So, yeah, it will not count as a word, so I won't give you marks for it, but I won't take one off. But if it's a good reference, you get the mark for the actual reference here. Yeah.